'cause that's all I have left. If I don't, if I won't choose love, and pride's all I have left. If I don't choose love. Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Whether you are across town or across the globe, that snippet opening tonight's show is from the single Choose Love by Lori Kane. Well, I want to say thanks to my listeners who came to my big bash at the Goddess Temple on Saturday to launch my new book, Goddess Calling. We had a wonderful time, and it was incredible to see everyone's smiling faces, such upbeat energy. So thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone, including Ava, the priestesses of the temple, Rowan Storm, the Circle Singers, the Sacred Dancers, Maria and Marguerite, and Rowan's entourage of wonderful musicians. What a glorious night it was. And there are pictures on my Facebook page if you'd like to go look. And if you're in Southern California and missed that one and still want to see my presentation on why Washington, D.C. should be a sacred site of Goddess and hear my talk on why Goddess spirituality is today's liberation theology setting us free from patriarchy, you can hear me at Ollendorf, or as I call it, the Sophia Temple of Malibu, this Saturday from 7 to 9, but you have to RSVP. So if you want to come, you have to get in touch with me or reply to the Facebook event that I have posted on my Karen Tate page. Treat yourself. It is truly a remarkable place, Olander, the Sophia Temple, and I think I have a pretty special presentation for you, if the response last Saturday was any indication. Then, Sunday, the 27th of April, I'm going to be guest ministering at the Goddess Temple of Orange County on the topic of forgiveness. It's a difficult thing sometimes to do when we're really hurt and in pain and full of angst. I certainly know what that feels like, and hopefully over the years I've gained some wisdom and maybe I can shed some light on how to cultivate that ability, forgiveness, and maybe offer some advice on why we should try. Well, tonight I have with me Sharon Raji Maynard talking about a mystic view of Goddess. We're also going to talk about that grand cross that's happening in the last few days. I think as we speak here, this latter part of April, but Sharon will clarify. Then following later, we have Betsy Chassie. She is the filmmaker and producer of the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, discussing the movie and her book, Tipping Sacred Cows. Don't you just love that title? Well, we'll see if it means the same thing to Betsy as it does to me, because I think maybe I've been tipping sacred cows for the last 20 years. Yes, tipping sacred cows in our society. In the conversation with Sharon, both should make for some interesting conversation. But first, just a couple shout-outs. I'd like to say hi to Hansa, who posted on my Goddess Calling Facebook page thanking me for the radio show. She said, after listening to several interviews, especially the one with Anne Baring, she feels so blessed to be on the path of Goddess spirituality and thanks me for inspiring her. Well, thank you, Hansa. You're gas in my tank, too. And thanks to Bob Hieronymus of 21st Century Radio for having me on his show, which airs in the Virginia and Washington, D.C. area to discuss my new book, Goddess Calling, about how the sacred feminine liberates us from patriarchal oppression. Soon there will be links to that interview that I did Easter Sunday on my Facebook and websites. And I want to congratulate foremother and feminist, author and activist, Genevieve Vaughn. Let me see if I can find what I was going to read. Yes, here it is. Genevieve at the conference, at the 2014 Conference of Association for the Study of Women in Mythology, Genevieve Vaughn received a special award for her work toward peace and economic justice. They said by unanimous vote, the Association for the Study of Women in Mythology Board of Directors has selected Genevieve Vaughn as the 2014 recipient of the Saga Special Recognition Award for Contributions to Culture and History. Named for the North's great goddess, this award recognizes her tireless work to develop and advance projects that focus on principles of international peace and economic justice. Her influential book, Forgiving, Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange, has set forth feminist economic principles for creating a maternal economy as a basis for social change. Her creation of the International All-Women Activists Foundation for a Compassionate Society based in Austin, Texas, back in 1987 through 2005, forever changed reality for many women and some men by practicing maternal caring in the public sphere. During its two decades of operation, important work locally, nationally, and internationally was achieved, work for peace, for economic justice, and to change the paradigms that divide us by heteronormative, racist, classist, or nationalist categories. Those who were empowered by this work remain deeply grateful for what Genevieve's visionary perspective taught them. So congratulations, Genevieve Vaughn. She is also the foundress of the Sekhmet Temple out in Indian Springs, or Cactus Springs, which is about 45 minutes outside of Las Vegas, dedicated to the lion-headed Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, which is an archetype for women's empowerment these days. And unfortunately, there has been an incident there. And I want to share this with folks in case they haven't heard about it. Maybe they can lend prayers, maybe lend their energy to help the situation, or maybe they even have some information that might lead to the recovery of the Sekhmet statue out there. Because the statue of Sekhmet in the Goddess Temple in Cactus Springs, Nevada, has been stolen. Someone during the night, a few nights ago, took the statue. We don't know who it is. It was by some unknown persons. The priestess out there found a necklace that someone had placed around her neck lying in the dirt outside the temple entrance, indicating she was probably lifted up and placed in a car trunk, or more likely the back of the truck. This is not a little statue that you put on a table. This is almost a life-size statue of the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet. If you go on Facebook and go to the Sekhmet Temple, you will see a picture of her. We're all in shock. We're all saddened. We don't know who would have done this. It's really unfortunate. But there is more than a $2,000 reward being offered. We're hoping that she will make her way back home. So if you know anything about that, or you just care about it and want to lend your energy toward helping her make her way home or helping us find the statue, please do. The more of us focused on this, lending good energy to it, the better. So I hope you'll stay with me after my two interviews. I have some interesting things to share, one of which comes from longtime listener Pat. Because it seems scientists have discovered four species with sex-reversed genitalia. Sounds kind of interesting. Interesting stuff. Anyway, turning to tonight's show, let's begin with Sharon Raji Maynard discussing a mystic's view of goddess. Welcome, Sharon.
Well, thank you very much, Karen.
I am so glad to have you with me.
You know, it's your introduction. I'm just writing all this down.
Never a dull moment. Never a dull moment, I swear.
That.
Well, you know, before we start, and maybe these two things are related, but I know you want to talk about the Grand Cross. That's kind of a unique thing that's happening this month. And our topic is a mystic's view of goddess. Would it make sense? Where do you want to begin? The cross, how they're related, if they're related? I throw it to you.
Let's start with a mystic's view of goddess.
Okay.
And that could be because the way I view goddess or the woman's place on the planet is similar and yet coming maybe from a different place. Because as I grew up in a patriarchal religious community, very supported there, by the way, because they took good care of us. We didn't have any responsibilities except having babies and fixing food, but nevertheless outgrew that particular way of being and realized that I also had a great deal of connection to being, to males and pleasing men, et cetera, and very disconnected from women, which is very typical when you're in a system that discriminates.
Sharon, I want to make sure we chat.
Yes.
Because, I chat about that because you said you felt very what was the word you used? You felt very, did you say comfortable toward the other women, but toward the, you in community, you felt, did you say taken care of or what was the word you used?
In a patriarchal system that I grew up in, it was patriarchal, and yet the men felt like they were taking care of us. They were responsible for us. They would speak to God and they would tell us what God said to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to worry about interpreting things, thinking things through on our own,
right,
et cetera. And,
because, I've read the only reason I interrupt you here, and I'm sorry,
sure.
And maybe what I read was a biased view. It obviously wasn't someone who lived in the kind of community you lived in. But she was talking about some women who live in these communities and, where women aren't expected really to do much more than, like you said, cook and have babies.
Mm-hmm.
And, women are promised, that they're going to be coddled and cared for and revered. But oftentimes, and feel free to tell me I'm wrong, that there are exceptions. The article said that these types of communities often attract men who don't, in fact, do those things. They attract men who really want to dominate and often abuse the women. And because the women aren't used to, standing up for themselves, they end up a victim. So it becomes a really kind of a sad situation. Is that the extreme or is that the norm or... or was this woman just totally off base?
Well, and when I grew up, I'm in my 70s. When I grew up, that was probably more normal in the whole country than just in my religious community.
True.
Women were taken care of. And so that was very norm. But whenever you put your foot on a path and the path is a little bit off balance, when you first start on that path, it's a little bit off balance. But the longer you are on that path, the more unbalanced it becomes. And so if you stay on that path many years down the road, you attract the kind of men who take advantage of and therefore dominate, abuse, etc. is common. Jimmy Carter and the elders, when they studied for 2 years, what is it that is causing this violence against women in our world? And their conclusion was religion. Because of that removal of the women within leadership positions, looked mm-hmm. at as second-class citizens, although that's not the words they would use, but we were and still are, that opens the door for men who abuse. And that's
right.
The conclusion they
well,
came
it
to.
Almost gives them license. I mean, it's almost as
it
if
does.
They probably feel entitled, to do whatever to anyone beneath them, women, children, animals, the planet, because they're the big kahuna mm-hmm. on the planet. There's nobody above them, especially, I think, if they're a white male Christian.
Well, and if they're speaking to God and God's speaking to them, the only one they're accountable to is God, and they're interpreting that. So
yeah, isn't that convenient?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So it's like that. Like I said, when you first put your foot on a path that's just a little unbalanced, at first it doesn't feel too off balance. But the further you go down that path, the more unbalanced it becomes. It just becomes more and more extreme.
Okay.
So,
okay.
You know, so when I was in my 40s and I realized I probably had learned everything I could learn in that particular religion, I left not because I was upset or, but I just was, I wanted more.
Were you
and,
evangelical or quiverful?
Oh, no.
Or what were you?
No, I was raised LDS Mormon.
Okay.
And for me, it was a, you know, it was a very lovely place to grow up. My father, you know, you get your identity through the man, and my father was well respected, and so the family was well respected. So it was a good place for me to grow up. But, you know, again, when you're ready to learn more, you often have to let go of what you have,
mm-hmm.
even if it's comfortable for you. And that's
yeah.
what I did. And then I when I let go and I realized that I was left with this sense of real connection to the male and knowing how to do well to please the man, but also had distanced myself from women, and that was a curious thing to me. Part of my healing was to figure out what that was about. Well, my healing journey, the reason I call myself mystic is because when I was doing an interview, because I've been doing interviews since 71, too, you know, a long time, and I was interviewing a woman who grew up in the same culture I'd grown up in, and she was in New York City doing chakra crystal balancing or crystal chakra balancing. I thought it would be an amazing interview. How did she go from there to where she was, you know? And in the process, was introduced to a hands-on energy work, which was totally unknown for women in my culture growing up. But I really found the value of it. Had previously learned about affirmations, and I was really expanding my life with that and hands-on healing. But I didn't like the onion layer approach that we were being taught in that personal growth, New Age, metaphysical time frame of the early 90s. It was too slow. I didn't want to have to do week by week by week by week work with my clients. I wanted them to get into their path and live their purpose, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had been working with a spiritual guide. I'm very telepathic, so I've been working with spiritual guides for about 18 years by then. And so I turned to that group and I said, you know, I love this affirmation work. It's powerful. The chakra balancing, working with crystals and gemstones is powerful, but I want to go where I can learn to go right to the core of the onion. I want to go to what is the cause of humanity's pain. We have been cycling in this pain forever, and I want to go to the core. I do not want to do onion layer. Where can I go to learn that? And they said, that's not the way it's being done on the planet, and if that's what you want to do, we'll have to teach you and bring back the histories that has been forgotten. So I said, I'm for it. So they said, first of all, don't read anything, because the answers aren't in anything yet you will read. Get a journal, ask us questions, we'll bring you people, you work with them, it'll bring up more questions, they'll line upon line, you know. We will
And this
restore.
Is your spirit guides telling you this.
This is my spirit guide that I've been
okay.
working with
okay.
them for like 18 years. So
okay.
So that's how I began to understand the history, what I call the history of this galactic family that's now on the Earth, from the beginning point, rather than looking at the Earth through through archaeology or written history or glyphs or whatever, and try to make sense of who we were, you know?
Okay.
They said, this is, you know, why are we on this adventure? Part of that was finding a way to identify what's the major purpose for their life, and I would call it an assigned vibration. And I would use colors. So if my client on the table, they would say, this person's assigned vibration for this lifetime journey is to step into their power, which would my color scheme would be clear yellow, would step into their power. Or it might be to remove their blocks about not being lovable so that they can receive love. Each of us have a big general purpose along with, you know, the playground we play with in the smaller purposes of that. So I was having a good time asking questions. It was huge research. It was a big research project. Lots of questions, lots of answers.
Have you put all of this into a book?
I have put it into two books.
Okay.
The third on the way, yes. So all of a sudden I went, oh, I wonder if there is a purpose, that why would a soul come into a female body versus a male bodysuit? Would there be a reason? They said, yes. I said, is there an assigned vibration that is part of the female body mission for a female body? And they said, yes, it is correct use of power to lead. I went, wow, we got that all wrong. Well, then what's the assigned vibration, the general purpose for the male bodysuit? And they said, to nurture. And I went, whoa, we got that one wrong too.
We have it backwards.
We have it backwards. And then they explained to me the story of why that was. And it was all about the Adam and Eve story in the garden when supposedly, you know, it's like a myth, but there's truth in it. When I'm going to go to Lilith. So when the serpent, who really represents wisdom, Sophia, the serpent of the ancient teacher, went to the woman and said, now it's time for you to take on your mission, and the mission is to know the difference between life and love, and what will bring love and life, and that which will distract, eliminate life or evil, good and evil. That was the woman's job, correct use of power, to be able to identify this form, this frequency, this food, this fracking, these guns will destroy life, and therefore it cannot stay in this form on the planet. It has to be here for the good. And that was our mission.
So how did it get turned on its head? How did things end up so backwards?
Because there were external gods, if you will, that already controlled us, and these were not the gods of good. These were from societies whose agenda were to use others.
You mean before? I mean, are you like talking Atlantis, Lemuria? Way before that even.
Before the Earth was even created. Yes, they were already part of our life stream, and we were trying to get out from under their ownership. And the woman had the responsibility to help us get out from under their ownership. So it was our job to identify their energy and say, no, you cannot be here. And it was the male's job to keep us infused with that vision, with that life, with that love, while they, you know, we had the authority and the men did not.
Wow.
And it wasn't that the men were weak, but they took upon themselves the contracts of the woman, so that they carried a male contract for ownership and the female contract for ownership. They carried that within their bodysuit, which made us women free of the contract. So we could then have the authority that says, you do not own me, not on this planet. You do not own me. And therefore, I can speak and say, this is good, this is evil. That's why it was the woman's role. But as soon as that ownership energy saw what was going on, then that, you see, the God that came into the garden, that mm-hmm. God that came into the garden is symbolic of that invader energy, ownership energy, and basically said to Adam, You're wrong, and you cannot know good from evil. You cannot create effortlessly. They were thrown out of the garden, and Eve, this is again a myth, how it says in the myth, it's like Eve wasn't strong enough to stand up and say, I know who you are. You go back to your home planet. She wasn't strong enough at that point. And that's what happened. The woman wasn't strong enough at that point and thought she could give herself a little time to strengthen, but indeed there was many manipulation of energy cripplings that then they started using the male bodysuit, which they had the right to do, to attack women. So that's
Wait,
why
who
women...
who used the male bodysuit to attack women? Explain that a little bit.
The invader, that invader society has had owned us. We'd given away our guns because they had steady hands, and they turned the guns on us. So that through deceit, through battles even, they had owned us. And so coming onto this planet, the male bodysuit contained the two contracts of ownership instead of just one, to leave the female bodysuit clear. But as soon as it was detected that we had a plan afoot to get rid of them way back then, that those usury societies started to manipulate through the bodysuit that they owned, the male bodysuit, they started to manipulate actions, behaviors, thought processes through the bodysuit of the men and attacked women. When women were attacked and vulnerable, then they could be hitchhiked, if you will. They could put devices to hitchhike on us, that then we became crippled also, way back when.
Well, this is some interesting stuff. So these guides that were telling you all of this, mm-hmm. is it possible for you to know who they are or where they're from? Or how old they are, or anything like that.
Yeah, they're from our family life stream. They're from our galactic life stream. They exist in. I work with in 64 dimensions rather than the 8 of the body mind spirit paradigm of Earth. I work in 64, and we have a team. They exist pretty much in each of those levels, and we don't identify. I've never identified them. Like I want to speak to my Archangel Michael. I've always identified them by quality of characters. What is their quality of characters? And that's what they have to be aligned with.
So in other words, if you want to talk to compassion or if you want to talk to healing or something like that, that's how you sort of look for them?
No, the way that I do it is I define the quality of character for my spiritual teachers and guides are, and then I define the kind of qualities of across the board for all of them. So wisdom, integrity, truth, commitment to our galactic family's highest good, commitment to our evolutionary return, etc. So they have to all align to the qualities that I specified. And in the beginning, then I would, everything I would get, every written thing I would get, I would read it through afterward after I'd received it, and then determine, is this the kind of action, words, suggestions that would come from a being of light, love, integrity, and wisdom? So I did a lot of checking, and still do, as we go through the day.
Wow. So really what you're saying is this all did sort of go wrong for humanity in the garden. And so, you know, the version that most of us know of the garden is, I guess, kind of warped, distorted. And it was really Eve that didn't have the strength to fend off this. You called him bodysuit, the male bodysuit of...
She didn't have the strength to stand up, and confidence probably, to stand up to that energy being that in the garden appeared as the God. To be able
okay.
to sense his energy, that his energy wasn't in alignment to love and greater good, but was an energy of deceit.
Now, is that God the God of the Bible? Or is, you know, the Bible even just sort of a distortion too? I mean, are the two related at all?
I think most of our history is a distortion. You know, you could say that the garden might have represented the period of time when we really had that equanimity between male and female working together. That's how it came into being. And when you could say this was a goddess culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was turned on its head. Yeah, and then when those invader energies came in, as they still do,
it was the women who they really went after, because it was the women in those cultures that held everything together, that held
right.
the vision for the new, that held the good for the community, who wove the relationships and was honored and respected. So they had to go after the women.
And
to,
destabilize
to
in, so that they could
absolutely.
Take over.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's
absolutely.
Like Putin doing in Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. A really interesting concept there, that the Gordon story, you know, really maybe is representative of the matriarchal or matrilinear
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And when things start to go bad, that's when the women are no longer the ones that are taking care of society. That's a very
right.
interesting thought, Sharon.
Well, you know,
so
if,
and we've been suffering as a result ever since.
We have, because we haven't had until just very, very recently, we haven't had a return to our own, to the woman authority. And so it's not that, you know, I hear a lot that, well, you know, we've all had male-female lifetimes, which is really true, and it's just about balancing the male-female within ourselves. That's only part of the story, really small part of the story, because it's getting back to the original mission. And at this point in time, you know, it's still the women who need to stand up, wake up, and say, wait a minute, my voice, my presence can sense, because that's my skill. I am an intuitive, sensitive being that is supposed to be tasting the fruit of forms of information and tasting it and saying, that is off. That doesn't feel like it's going to benefit. And so
are you saying, Sharon, that
society.
we aren't aiming for an we shouldn't be aiming for an egalitarian society? We should be aiming more for the way you think it was in the beginning, before the garden, where women were actually the ones that took care of society, and I hate to use the word ruled, but you know, were the overseers, the caretakers.
I think that what we're looking at, first of all, is for especially women to get to the place that says, that puts them back as the ones who say what is acceptable and not acceptable in our world, and that can muster the men who agree to those values, who muster enough of us women who agree to those values, that we just stand in the front and say, we will not have Monsanto in our world. We will not have Monsanto in our country. We will not have fracking in my backyard, and stand in that nonviolence place, because that's where we're at now, is we're back to the place where that invader-type energy that we call greed, that we call patriarchy, that we call usury, that we call power over, is very rampant in our world, because it was not eliminated at the beginning.
Right.
And so now, taking back our authority to say, out, 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 you know, the women, I think, need to lead the way, but I think there are men who absolutely are on board with
right,
that
right.
same thing.
Now, were
and,
the burning times just another sort of big push for these body suits, as you call them? Was that another battle to try to obliterate the feminine?
Yes, very much so. It's been constant. I mean, we still see it in our world today. Why do you think there's domestic violence and violence against women and rape during wartime? Women have to be destroyed for that power over control agenda, usury agenda, to win.
Well, Sharon, I know this is a hard question, and I don't mean to put you on the spot with it, but I will admit that sometimes I have trouble staying positive and optimistic when I look around and see women who are handmaidens of this Where are you using to call the, you know, the evil bodysuit?
The bodysuits are what we're in. You're in a female body. I'm in a female bodysuit. It's a bodysuit, right? It
okay.
helps us get around.
Right.
Their energy, some of them, you know, have incarnated into bodysuits. But it's an agenda. It is a society whose agenda is usury. They are not part of our family. Our galactic family's agenda is to experience aspects of our nature, which is good. That's
so. But
our
who?
Agenda.
How? You know, so that I can refer to them. These usury
yeah.
people.
I call them parasitics.
Usury. What do you call
I
them?
I call them parasitics.
Parasitics. Okay, that's perfect. Okay, so
yeah.
the parasitics. I get very discouraged when I
mm-hmm.
see that so many women or just play into that game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the right wing women who are not they're propping up the patriarchy, you know, they're
mm-hmm.
complicit in their own oppression. You know, it's almost as if there isn't enough solidarity amongst women. You know, you have,
right.
I'm sure you're probably aware of Phyllis Chesler, famous, you know, foremother feminist, wrote Woman's Inhumanity to Woman. I mean, women are horrible to one another.
Right.
You know, they don't
yeah.
stand in solidarity. Is that part of this, you know?
That's part of the burning times. It's part of the burning times. During the burning times, because I do personal sessions with individuals, you know, going back, what's the sabotage, or why am I living less than, you know, that kind of work. And it's very, very common for a woman to be taken back to her time, maybe in a village. I've had many, many clients going back to a village in which the women met monthly, and they were the visionaries, and they, you know, were the stability, et cetera. And yet they knew that there was these invading forces coming, physical, coming through their area, and they would be coming into their village. And they knew, and I've seen them in circle going with sadness, going into their trees, into their mountains, to stand in circle the last time and make a contract with one another that they would stay small, that they would keep each other small. They had to pull each other down and stay small for the sake of surviving through the invaders, because they didn't have the strength to keep them out. So in order for the women to stay safe, for the families to stay safe, for their village to stay safe, the women had to shut up and stay small. And those contracts still exist. So that's one reason women pull each other down. They grow to a certain level. They support each other just past survival. They start expanding, then they pull each other down. Or you can go to the concubines, the concubine era, when, hey, we needed a man to survive literally, and our children needed that man to survive literally. So if we were not the favorite, then we might be out on the street. So we had to pull each other down. I mean, there's so many things that we have experienced as women amongst ourselves because of that power over patriarchal, and I would rather call it parasitic energy, that we have been healing that for the last. We really started majorly by 2005, making major, major differences to free women energetically. So that I am seeing in my life just in the last 6 months changes in how women are with each other in ways I've never seen in my entire career. The healing is occurring. So that, you know, we could say takes us to the Grand Cross. Well, let me say one other thing, though. Because now women in our day, including you, we have the right and indeed the responsibility when we sense or see anything in our world that is basically destroying evil, taking away life, like Monsanto, like toxins in our food, you know, that we have the right to go into that quiet place inside and say to that whatever we're connected to in that higher world, those higher dimensions, this is not acceptable on our planet. This is not acceptable. These have to go back to their home planet. They came from another planet. They don't belong here. They have to go back to their planet. And we women who are aware, can ask for that type of removal. Not acceptable here, take them home. Not acceptable here, take them home. We are ridding ourselves of that energy. So now we go to the Grand Cross. The Grand Cross is a Grand Cross, a Grand Square, a Grand Trine, Divine Protection. This playground is so busy and so full of things that the universe is saying to us, here is the energy, walk with us in it. And the energy is saying, basically, if I were to put it in concise terms, are you going to have, you humanity, are you going to have the strength and the tenacity to allow your structures of domination that you have felt were accurate? These are the sacred cows, you know, that you're talking about with your next caller. Will you have the strength and tenacity to name the cows, the emperor has no clothes, and allow them to be dissolved in order that you can listen deeply to each other as you create new structures, first in imagination, then with all kinds of fantasy and all kinds of manifestation tools to create a culture based on the values that women hold for those they love. That's in a nutshell what's going on.
Wow.
And so if we take the tack that this, and it could happen through mass, you know, it could happen through earthquakes, it could happen through, you know, little war-type stuff, it could happen through, like here in Washington State, we had the Oso landslide, terribly awful landslide, and yet everyone came together like we do as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But can we do it consciously? Will we do it consciously? This isn't something to just duck your head and make your way out of it. This is a time when we can grab hold and say, I'm anchoring for myself and for the planet the capacity to come from our common values, our unity, with the ability to forgive, to be generous, and to love others within our diversity and create a new world structure. That's what we're being called to. Now, is that minor?
No, that's global change. That's a total conscious turnaround. It's a paradigm shift.
Yes.
Because how many thousands of years have we been suffering, at the mercy of the parasitics?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to shift things, we need it so badly.
And
I hope
Vaughn.
I live to see it, you know.
Well,
how long it's going to take for this to happen?
Well, you know, I haven't asked them. All I know is that the energy door is here in a way it's never been before. You know, we have the Genevieve Vaughns of the world who have, like, been doing this, like Karen Tate's of the world. You've been doing this. You've been making the call for this. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
Genevieve Vaughn dissolving the economic structure of the power over power and money to the few, right? She's
right.
been calling for that. And here it is. And so what happens? The statue gets taken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of what can be, what looks like the oppression or the opposite or the military action. I mean, that will not deter them from staying true to what they're doing, which is
right.
Which is calling
yeah, because it
for
was really
economic.
Weird when the statue got stolen. Some of us
uh-huh.
were saying, "Well, you know, this could be retribution. But maybe this is some divine plan too,"
yeah.
because it was
yeah.
really interesting that suddenly Sekhmet was in the news all over Las Vegas.
All over.
To people that didn't even know who Sekhmet was.
Didn't
you know,
even,
suddenly
and now
she
you're
was,
talking about it? Yeah.
You know, it's almost as if she was being birthed in the mainstream world through
exactly.
this event.
Exactly. Exactly. You see, it's and with Uranus involved, Uranus does these quick things, like all of a sudden the rug gets pulled or you get a sudden intuitive insight and things change and happen. And
yeah.
and if, you know, so what I'm saying to my clients and listeners is like, you know, here's a whole audio of how I see we can look at these energies. And that's okay, that's one part of it, but then how can you as an individual anchor those energies in behalf of yourself and the planet? How can we as the human beings that are conscious say, yes, we are on that with you, and we are claiming that we are going to transform from A to Z with grace, with ease. We are going to bring all of our skills, our circle principles, our deep listening ideas and concepts, and we are going to bring all the best of who we are to make this change happen effortlessly and lead the way. You know, are we going to participate with this, or are we just going to go like, I don't know what it's about, but I'm bending off the energy, you know?
Right, right. Just sort of with faith and certainty.
Yes, yes, exactly. You see, women, the thing that I, another thing I want to talk about, if you don't mind, with women, because couple years ago, I remember somebody, an article saying something about where's the woman leaders,
right.
And I've been involved with what's called the circle work, women sitting in circles or businesses in circles, and you sit in circle, and I'm going to say this even though you may know it and your listeners may know it, but you sit in circle so that you can see each other's eyes. And you do check-ins, and you are there to listen respectfully and deeply. You're not going to add to the conversation, to the words the woman is speaking. You're not going to try and change it, and you're not trying to fix it. You're holding a space for her to be heard only. And everybody gets heard in whatever way they want to say. And that's been going on for quite some time. And what I've noticed in my, because I worked around women organizations a lot like you have, is that the women, when they first come into a circle, they've never had the opportunity to be in a community where they can just be heard. So they might come in, and the first time they just listen to everybody else, and they pass. They pass the talking stick. They don't have anything to say. The next time they come, but they're glad to be there. Next mm-hmm. time they come and they go like they're smiling and they feel good to be there, but then their inner pain comes to the fore. They didn't even know it would be there, and it's just like, oh, they have a place to say how much pain they're in. And the next time they come and the talking stick gets passed, and then they said, you know what? I'm starting to remember what I used to want to do. So their dreams wake up. Okay, and then they share the dreams, and all of a sudden, you have a circle of women who are not following one leader. They've had the opportunity to be valued, to have their voices heard, and now we're like starlings. Women do not fly like geese. They fly like starlings. So we have this huge flock. And we're going to from point A to point B, and we're in the sky, and there's a small group of us that feel the wind under our wings, and we take off to the left, and another to the right, and another goes up, and another group dips down, and then we come back into group, and then we come back into group, and we dance our way from point one to point two, because we're starlings. We are all leaders. We are leaders. I guess that's what one of the angst I had about the word goddess. Because mm-hmm. we're goddesses. We mm-hmm. are multiple. We're all leaders. We're all
right.
leaders.
Right, right,
and,
right.
And so you can't say who's the leader in a woman society or a group. It's like we're all leaders.
Right, yeah.
And sometimes
yeah.
I'm in a knitting circle and sometimes in a book discussion. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a partnership, you know, it's egalitarian, you know, it's shared leadership. You know, sometimes, you know, one person is going to take the lead and then you switch off, you know.
Yeah. Or sometimes there's two people taking the lead and going two directions, but we're not separate. We're just
yeah.
off two different directions, right?
Right. And we're not, and you know, we don't have models for that. So I think it feels uncomfortable because we're not familiar really with it. It seems disorganized.
Yeah. And I think that's why for me, you know, one of the things that I'm doing in my women's groups is I am bringing it to their attention that this is how they function and it is good. Now, when you work together in the paradigm model, which I think is what we all have to look at, is the male paradigm, the female paradigm. And the male model in leadership is a lot like the geese. You have a leader, and you get from point A to B because the leader tells you where to go. And there are times when that type of leadership is the best. And there are times that that the female type of leadership of the starlings is the best, you know.
And so you know, it seems to me right now, and you know, tell me if I'm like way off base, but it seems like the starling approach maybe is so necessary now because there's so much that's messed up. There's so many things that need attention. And maybe that starling approach allows us to cover more territory more quickly.
It does. And yes, it really does. It allows us to do that. And, you know, here's, and I, if your listeners have the exact reference point, I got this over Facebook and it was about a year ago, and I didn't know that you had to save links, so I didn't save the link to it. So it came across my page, and it said that what the research, most recent research with women in corporations, were saying that it wasn't at 20% or 30% or 33% that women begin to be heard. It was at 67%. That until we had a 67% presence in a board meeting, women were treated in a corporation the same way they were treated in the world. They were either, they said what they said and then talked over. They said what they said and ignored. They said what they said and were put down. And it wasn't until 67% was reached that there was, all of a sudden, they were heard in a similar way that the male counterparts were heard. And I think that's so important in what you're saying. It's like women, we have stopped, we've got to drop off our survival skills of pulling each other down, of gossiping each other about each other, of withdrawing from someone who's successful because for whatever reason. We've got to start holding hands with one another and bringing our groups together, our organizations together in some fashion to show strength. Like you march in my parade, I'll march in yours.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes, instead of it being a competition.
That's right.
There's a wonderful thing over Facebook that I actually used it as in my presentation Saturday night. Girls compete, women empower. We got to get rid of this compete stuff.
Absolutely. We've got, and you know, I think, you know, as I'm reading the Grand Cross, it's like there's energy bigger than an individual here, and there's even energy bigger than a whole group of people here. Come in our way, and will be underpinning us. When you're talking about Pluto and Uranus and Saturn and Neptune, you know, they don't bow down to human ideas.
So you're saying that we're going to be assisted in this
Absolutely.
Endeavor.
Absolutely.
So even though it feels humongous, it feels insurmountable, we are not in this alone.
Not only are we not in it alone, it's like the energies are being prepared for us. Like when I want to change my life, I use what I call reality shift work, which is similar to affirmations. And so I have to kind of stay with that, you know, get my brain on board and my emotions on board and all of that to get that underpinning energy. Well, those planets are putting that underpinning energy in place as we speak.
So it's like we're riding a wave. We're more like they're providing a wave for us to ride.
They are. That's right. And if it feels like a bucking ride, but we understand it, we can surf with it. Now in August and September, there's going to be another astrological wave, and this one is more like put the fire under us. You know,
to motivate us. You mean
to motivate us or to bring manifestation, and. You know, when there's an energy that says sudden insight, those who will get it with a sudden insight intuition will get it that gently. Those who aren't going to get it or won't get it that gently, they might be in a car accident. They'll get it in a bigger way. So that's why I'm saying if we can understand what the energies are there for, and embrace them and claim them as our own and say, for example, you know, we have learned from women's values and insights how to let joy help us expand our world by transforming structures that divide humanity to create socially responsible structures of good. See, we can frame it. We can take the energy and frame it, make it our own.
Sharon, we are starting to run out of time. You probably have like about 2 or 3 minutes. Do you want to leave that as your wrap, or is there something else you want to say in the closing minutes?
I would just say to all women, it is your responsibility and really divine mission, first of all, to stand up for that which gives life and good to those you love. Don't be afraid to do that. Look at this Grand Cross energy and realize it can assist you if you just embrace it in a way that says, I embrace and move through this effortlessly, easily, miraculously, with great community support. I mean, frame it. We are creators. He who is the master of energy, he who masters energy, will determine where this game goes. And that's us women.
Okay. Well, Sharon, please share with listeners your radio show, your books, if there's a website that listeners could get in touch with you if they want to, you know, use your services.
Well, you know, the best way to probably at this point to get a hold of me is message me through my Facebook, which is Sharon Raji, R-I-E-G-I-A, Maynard. I post most things there. I have a lot of other things going on. I have a book. My books are all called, starts with The Ancient Ones, and the latest book is The Ancient Ones, Out of the Shadows. But all that is easily accessed through my Facebook page.
Okay.
Thank you, Karen.
Well, you know, this has been very enlightening. This is, you know, I'm really glad you brought up the Grand Cross stuff, because you explained it in a way that I hadn't heard it explained before. You know, most people were sort of, you know, it had this, you know, this sort of tinge of fear to it, fear-based. Not that they were trying to be fear-mongers, but it was unsettling, and it just wasn't positive.
Yeah. It's however you take it. The energy is there for us to use it. We can use it in positive ways, big time.
Well, Sharon, thank you. Listeners, we have been talking to Sharon Raji Maynard, who was given the mission to dream awake the bones of our ancient mothers and could only do that with the help of spiritual teachers who knew the wisdom of the bones. Armed with bone information, she has encouraged women to take back their mission for this world through personal sessions, workshop, wisdom mentorships, books, radio show host, and a convener of the first Women's Grassroots Congress. She is in empowering collaboration with women reclaiming their divine mission. And that's exactly what we talked about tonight. Sharon, thank you so much. And please stay in touch with me. Maybe you should come back on the show as we're about to start in that next phase, you said.
I would love that, yeah.
You said in August and September.
August, September.
Okay.
And then we can see in the meantime what we've done.
Yes. We'll book a date. I'll get in touch with you in the next few days. Thank you so much, Sharon.
You bet. Bye-bye. Blessings.
Bye-bye.
Blessings, women.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you for staying with us. And I think my next guest is actually on the switchboard. Let me double check and see if this is Betsy. Hi, Betsy. Is that you?
That's me.
Oh, wonderful. I wasn't sure if this was your phone number. I took a chance, and there you are. Thank you so much.
Well,
I'm looking forward to our conversation. I did a little bit of an intro at the top of the show. I told listeners who you were and that we're going to be talking about your book, Tipping Sacred Cows. But let me give listeners a little bit more detail. So we are about ready to chat with Betsy Chassie. Is that right, Chassie?
Chassie, but it doesn't matter.
Chassie.
It's all good.
Thank you. Betsy Chassie, an internationally known author, filmmaker, and speaker. She is the co-creator of the film What the Bleep Do We Know? And the author of three books, including Tipping Sacred Cows, Metatonia, A Transformative Change of Heart, and the companion book to What the Bleep, Discovering the Endless Possibilities for Altering Your Everyday Reality. She blogs for The Huffington Post, Intent.com, and other sites, and she continues to make provocative films exploring human potential and the nature of reality, or whatever it is we humans are hanging out in. Betsy, thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I was commenting before you were on the line about the title of your book, Tipping Sacred Cows, and I'm wondering if we mean the same thing when we say tipping sacred cows. I sort of feel like I've been doing that for 20 years as I sort of tip the sacred cow that is the status quo, tip the sacred cow that is patriarchal religion. Is that what you mean by sacred cows as well, or is there more to
Absolutely.
It than that?
Absolutely. I mean, to me, a sacred cow is anything that we hold up against criticism or something we don't question.
Okay.
So, yes, I would give you a resounding yes.
So, I mean, you do so many things, you know, filmmaker, author, speaker, like most women today, you know, you probably wear a dozen hats. How
Right.
did you come to writing Tipping Sacred Cows? Was this before or after the movie What the Bleep?
Well, it was after. I mean, ultimately, I came, you know, I've been doing... In the last few years, I got divorced 3 years ago, and I really had to come to this realization that it was time to actually, I don't like to say the word redefine, because what I realized is that I'd actually never defined me myself. I had attached a whole series of sacred cows and beliefs that I had picked up along the way, and that defined me. But I really hadn't taken the time to just say, oh, I have a choice here in how I would like to define myself. And so one of the things that I realized was that I am a storyteller. You know, I am a storyteller, and I'm a modern-day storyteller, and that, because before, you know, What the Bleep, you know, I would never even have said to you that I could write a paragraph, let alone a book. And, you know, I got on What the Bleep, and when I was hired on What the Bleep, I was, you know, I'd been a producer, but I'd never written anything, and then all of a sudden I became a writer and a director and a producer on What the Bleep. And so that kind of expanded my horizon in terms of my I am definition. And then when I got divorced, I felt really, you know, I started writing. One of the things I just started doing was writing as a journal. And then all of a sudden I realized, gosh, I love this. I love writing. And maybe I could add that to my little, you know, list of things that I do. And then I started to look at everything that I do, and I realized that, you know, I'm a storyteller.
Well, what do you say that's, especially for women, you know, in a patriarchal society, wouldn't you say sacred cows keep women conforming, and in their neat little box that, you know, sort of, you know, in some cases maybe keeps us under somebody's thumb or controlled, you know? It's, you know, we have certain roles, we have certain expectations.
Right.
And in
Right.
a way, those are sacred cows too, you know, the things that, how we're brainwashed, how we're indoctrinated, you know, what the bubbles that we live in, you know,
Right.
that sort of thing. So it's not always just maybe an institution. Maybe it's just
Right.
a belief system, too.
It's a belief. I mean, it's a belief system. And, I mean, this is a show about the feminine, and you refer to, you know, women. But I say that it's not just women. It's men. I would love to share with you a really interesting experience that I had recently. First of all, so I'm a mom. I have a 6-year-old boy, and I have a 10-year-old daughter. She's going to be 10 on Wednesday, so she wants me to call her 10. So I'm like, okay, she's made it to the double digits. And I had two things that happened to me recently that really shocked me in terms of, like, I think that I'm sort of this consciously aware mom, you know, I'm this trying to raise my children in this environment and where they're expanded minds and blah, blah, blah. And I was at a parade with my son and my daughter, and marching along were the cheerleaders. And my son looks at me and says, oh, I think I'm in love. They're so hot. And I laughed. I thought that was cute because he's 6, right?
Right.
So you think that's cute. And so, like, I laughed. And then as I'm walking away from the parade, I just had this, like, realization of, like, wait a minute. That's not okay. Like, I can't let him grow up like that. That's the programming. I'm now part of the, quote, problem that women have with men. I'm raising a young man, and I'm letting that be okay. And so that was the first moment of, like, for me as a mom. And it wasn't that I was intentionally doing that. It's just that's just the way society is, and we all think it's cute when the boys like the girls and the boy. And it was just like this huge awakening for me as a mom, you know, of like, whoa, I have a huge responsibility, not just in raising a child, but raising a man, you know, because we're in this place where, you know, a couple weeks after that, I was doing a workshop with a wonderful woman. I don't know if you know her or if you've had her on a show, but you should. Her name is Kate Montana, and she has an amazing book called Unearthing Venus. It's unbelievable. And I was with her doing a workshop, and she plays this game with the people in the workshop where she puts up two big posters and she puts masculine on one side and feminine on the other. And she asks you to throw out characteristics of each one. And I just kind of was sitting back because she was leading this part of the workshop, and I was observing all these women. And these are really great women. And I observed these women every time they had something negative or even in the way they delivered it, it was a masculine thing. And then all the sort of wonderful things were feminine things. And I was listening to this, and I literally had to interrupt. I said, you know, I have to stop. Because this, what Kate didn't say, let's have a man-bashing hour. You're turning the masculine into men. Masculine has nothing to do with men. Masculine is a quality, just like feminine is a quality. And mm-hmm. we each, as humans, have both.
Right.
And then, like, literally the next night I was at an event where we were this business networking thing, and the woman stood up and she said, we should be more like men. And I started to scream, and I thought, wait a second. You know, we got to stop blaming the men. The men were raised by mothers who didn't know any better, and I realized that because I'm a mom who was raising a little boy who for a long time played in with the programming that thought it was cute that he might have done certain things that were typically masculine, and mm-hmm. I had to get a greater awareness. Does that make sense to you? Like, I was so shocked.
Well, yeah,
it
does,
know?
Because it, you know, and it's probably especially hard as a mother raising a son today, because not only do you want to raise him to be a man, but you want to raise him not to be the kind of man that is really a lot of the men, not all the men, of course, but, you know, you want to raise him to be, you know, a more evolved man than
right.
than a lot of the men that are out there today, you know, that
right.
don't look at women as a sex object, or, you know, that really do want a partner, you
right.
know, men that aren't intimidated by a woman that has a brain,
right.
you know, so it's really hard because not only are you battling in a way, you know, you're trying to raise him, you know, to of course, you know, be a man for the future, to be somebody who can be a good husband. But, you know, it's almost as if you're battling society at the same time. You're trying to give him a different set of ideals than he sees when he turns on the TV for what being a man is about.
Right. And not only that, but I'm also having to become aware of my own hidden sacred cows around men and around that whole subject. Because if I'm not aware of the stuff that's going on in me or my belief systems around it, then I'm not consciously parenting him.
Right,
and that was
right.
a huge moment for me of like, you know, I mean, look, I mean, I'm a mom, and sometimes I lose it, and I'm not going to be, like, you know, higher consciousness 24/7. It just is not who I am at the moment. I'm doing my best. But it was a really big moment for me because I feel like, you know, I'm around a lot of, you know, women, and I suddenly had – I've just had this whole exploration into this, which is something I've been thinking about, which is this idea that I really think that feminists – and I hope I don't offend anybody, but this is my belief, you know, we kind of got it wrong because we're running around trying to say we should be equal to men, we should be this to men. And I've come to my own realization that, you know what, I really don't, I'm not a man. I'm not going to do things like a man. I'm not going to behave like a man. I'm going to be a woman who's capable, who has value and importance that's different than you, my man.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't think we disagree about that. You know, we're not saying that we want to be like men. We're just saying that we want to be women, and as women, we want to be equal partners. You know,
right? Well, and equal partners. But the thing that's interesting to me is that, you know, as I listen to a lot of young women, my book appeals to, you know, women who are younger, and I've been doing a lot of talks with college women and places like that. And I feel like there's this interesting disconnect about this particular part. And it's so fascinating to me because they almost want to shed their feminine, or they want to take over the feminine too much. And I feel like, you know, I'm kind of a masculine feminine girl. You know, even though I love great shoes and, you know, I love feminine things, supposedly, well, I guess you can call them feminine, but I'm kind of, you know, I'm forward, I'm direct, I have a lot of, quote, masculine tendencies, not male tendencies, masculine tendencies,
mm-hmm,
and there's a
mm-hmm.
really big difference, and it's really been fascinating to me to explore this because I feel like this is where we talk so much in our culture and in our the new age or the new thought or the spiritual about change. And like I realized recently, like if I'm really going to have an impact, then I really have to undo my own belief system around this and then become really conscious, because the changes may not necessarily happen in me or my generation completely, but if I can become more aware of how I communicate, what I do with my son, what I do with my daughter, and how I work with him on this subject, that's where the change comes.
Right, right, absolutely. Are you taking these new revelations and this new consciousness? Are you putting it into films or anything like that you know, we're maybe going to, you know, be able to get a DVD or see it on the screen, or how does it transfer into your work?
Well,
or
it doesn't,
just as
your
work
totally
as a mother?
Right now, I mean, for me, the way I become a storyteller is experiential. Like, I feel like I'm not a guru. I'm not a teacher. I'm just a human trying to make sense of the experience that I'm in. And because I happen to be great at telling stories, I share my experience. So I'm sort of in the experience of this now, and you will absolutely see it reflected within the next, possibly even 6 months. I'm working on a big project that I can't tell anybody about, but it'll launch in the next 6 months. That on the surface, it's very interesting, might seem horribly offensive to women, but that's part of what I'm really interested in doing in my work is that we, part of the sacred cows that we carry is because we love to become offended. We're quick to judge. We're quick to become offended. We're quick to take on the oh, this is sexist, or this is offensive, or this is degradation to women, or this is degradation to men. And I think that's part of actually the problem that most of humanity is facing right now, is that I have to be willing in my own life to take a step back from someone who I could absolutely interpret an experience as being sexist or sexually harassing or degrading to me. And if I take a moment and I just listen to my own filter, which is my belief system, which has been all of those things in my life, I've had all of those experiences, and then say, wait a second, does this person intentionally mean to do these things to me, or is this just their programming and they don't know any better? And when I start to act that way, it's been really fascinating, just in terms of like I spent a very long career as a line producer which is typically a male job, in a very male dominated industry, and I spent a significant amount of time in boardrooms where I was the only woman, and I learned how to navigate that environment very well. But I realized, gosh, you know, if I had just taken a moment, instead of being offended at them, to not educate them in a condescending way, but to help them learn that there's a different way to communicate, that they don't have to play that role and I don't have to play my role, that we could, if we just took that step back, we might actually have a whole different conversation. Now, it's very fascinating to me because I still deal with a lot of men and who are living in that programming. And I found that when I change the way I react to them, when I change the way, when I stop hearing them as, oh, there goes just another jerk man who's like, you know, living in the patriarchal society. When I let that chip off my shoulder and I just listen and then create an opportunity for us to have an authentic interaction about it, the whole thing goes away. Like that whole paradigm of man, woman, masculine, feminine, patriarchal, non-equality, it actually evaporates.
Well, it makes sense because I think another way to say maybe what you're saying is we're all being a little bit too politically correct, you know,
right,
and expecting everybody else to be on the same page with us and understand what's offensive and what isn't offensive when we all, you know, when that's a subjective thing. And if we take
right.
that out of the equation, then it sort of drops the barriers and we're able to just communicate as one human being to another and maybe have, you know, create something or have conversations that, you know, that there were walls up before, or we put walls up because we were being politically correct or had, you know,
yeah.
certain expectations or something.
And because, you know, I've also realized that most of the time, you know, there's this really great quote that's unknown and I'm going to mess it up, but basically it says, be kind because the person that you're dealing with is having just as much of a hard time as you are.
Yeah.
And we're all really bad communicators. That's the other thing I've realized. I am a horrible communicator because all of my communication comes from my belief systems. My reality is created by my perception. My perception is created by my belief system. So everything that comes out of my mouth is filtered that way. And everything that comes in, everything I hear, runs through the Betsy belief system. So, you know, this is a silly story. But, you know, I've always had body issues, like my whole life. You know, so I'm about to go on TV to promote my book, which, remember, is called Tipping Sacred Cows, which will be important in a second. I went out. I bought two new dresses. I was super excited. I put on the dress. I come running out to show my boyfriend, who's laying on the bed, and he looks at me with this sort of smile, and he goes, wow, that's awesome. I love the whole cow thing you've got going on. And I immediately heard, right, like, say that to a woman. Right. I immediately heard that I'm fat. Now, I could have run into the bathroom, torn off the dress, sobbed for hours, and we would have had a horrible evening. And I just stopped for a second, and I said, okay, the Betsy filter hurt. Wow, he just called me a cow. But is there another possible intention that he had, but because it came out the way he's a guy and it came out that way, maybe that's not what he meant? And so I just asked him, I'm like, okay. So you know me, and you know that I have body issues, and so what I heard you say was that my dress looks like a cow. And he started laughing, and he's like, you don't look like a cow, babe. Your dress is black and white. It's got the cow theme. Your book is called Tipping Sacred Cows. I'm calling you clever. I'm giving you a compliment.
There you go.
Know, that's just a very basic situation in which communication could have gone horribly wrong.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of what happens most of the time. And most people become really offended and, you know, war start. You know, I mean, it's really, if we just took a moment to go, wow, did he really mean that? You know?
Well, imagine, you know, I mean, we have a hard enough time talking to each other. Then we have emails. Now we have texting. I mean, the opportunity to miscommunicate is like 1,000%. It's a wonder anybody stays friends with anybody.
And then we love to be like, this is the thing that's cool about raising kids, because I learn so much about how I ended up being the way I am by watching my kids. And, like, my daughter is in that 10-year-old phase, and I think that based on the conversations I'm having with her other friends' moms, like, they're in that let's practice being offended at everything, anything anybody says phase. And it's so hilarious now because they become, oh, I can't believe you. I mean, they totally are trying that on.
Drama queens.
And so it's,
yeah.
Oh, my God. And so I can see now, like, oh, I know how this programming of let's just be offended and not actually listen phase came. It started when I was 10, and I just never really stopped. I just took that and ran with it.
Yeah, you know, you just have a little bit more of, more of an adult version of it now.
Right. Now, I just have more belief systems attached to it, more stories to go, oh, he just called me fat because when I was 7, this other person called me fat, so therefore everybody's calling me fat. I mean, it's just, it's insanity, and it's kind of funny. I mean, my book is very funny for that reason. I try to bring humor into everything that I do because I just feel like we all take everything way too seriously.
Yeah. We need to laugh more.
We need to laugh more.
Betsy, tell me, I feel like there's a good story here. At what moment did you figure out that you didn't have it figured out?
Wow. Well, I think that it was the moment that I woke up one day in my house with married and 2 kids, and I looked at my husband, and I was like, oh, my God, there's a burglar in my house, and then I realized the burglar was me. Like, I was the burglar. Like, I had stolen a whole reality and created it and had no idea, like, and had no idea how I created it and actually didn't really want it.
Wow.
And here
you had put yourself in this scenario, maybe because of societal expectations, family expectations, whatever, and now you're stuck. Is that sort of what you mean?
Right, exactly, because of all my shoulds, all my, you know, could-bes, all my ought-to-bes, all the stories that I told myself, as you know, got told as a child, all the belief systems I grabbed, you know, I was a thief. It's so much easier just to believe, you know, somebody tells you something, it's really easy to believe that as opposed to, like, stopping and saying, well, really, do I have to believe that? I actually don't. I mean, one of the greatest gifts that I had in getting divorced was, A, I had a great marriage. I got divorced. I have 2 awesome kids. And I lived the program. I lived the get married, get a job, be successful, have beautiful children, have nice house. I totally did that. So when I was finished with that, I had suddenly had this freedom. And this is what I write for a lot of divorce blogs and stuff, and I'm constantly telling divorced women who come to my program or my workshops, look, here's the cool thing, because, you know, you're in that phase of, like, my life is over. I'm like, no, here's the cool thing. You now have freedom because you don't have to follow the program anymore.
Right,
like, you
right.
don't actually have to do anything. You know, I know
totally what you mean. I mean, when I got married the first time, it's the same story. We all hear it.
Right.
Get married. Why? I skipped the kid thing, but I got married, got a job, bought a house, had cars, and then it was like, okay, is this all there is? You know?
Right.
And then for me, that all crumbled really early, and I ended up getting married a second time, moving out to California, totally changed my life. So I was lucky. I guess I probably really tipped all the sacred cows, a.k.a. expectations, really early, you know, got rid of all of that so I could lead a life that was my more, you know, I guess I call it being my more authentic self, who maybe
right.
I was meant to be rather than maybe what society tells me I should be or do.
Right. I'm just a slow learner, so it took me a long time to figure it out. And so, you know, I hit 40, and I just was like, oh, wow, this is freedom. You know, I can now have a boyfriend, not have a boyfriend. I can live, I can do what I want. I can have this career or not have this career. And
right.
That's what I taught, you know, it's funny. I mean, you probably get this a lot where you'll get asked by magazines and stuff for younger, the 20-somethings, and they always say, what would you say to your 20-year-old self? And I usually say, I probably wouldn't say anything because my 20-year-old self just wouldn't listen. And like, she knew it all and she'd be fine. And I had this realization actually today as I'm working on something. I mean, you know, for me, the sacred cows come in layers. And I'm never going to be done. That was another big sort of relief and letting go of the idea that at one point I would be done and I would somehow mm-hmm. have tipped all of my sacred cows and I'd be finished. There is no finishing.
I don't think so.
Yeah, and that was a relief because then I was like, oh, good. Like, I don't actually have to worry about when I'm going to be done.
Yeah.
But then... Yeah. Was this moment today where I'm you know, you think having kids would make you be like the perfect at patience, like you'd be the epitome of a patient being? No. I'm still working on this idea of patience. And today I realized, you know what's really cool is that I wouldn't have had this understanding of what I mean when I say the word patience if I didn't have all the experiences that I had up till this point. Like, I wouldn't have this ability to have this clarity on this subject. And that just, you know, for all the, it's like all the trials and tribulations that we all experience in life, I look at them and go, wow, that is so awesome, A, that I'm still alive, and that, you know, I don't have a drug addiction or a venereal disease, and that I I'm here, and that I have all that life experience to help me have a better understanding of this moment where I can really explore the word patience and understand what it means. And so I don't, you know, when people always say, what do you say to a 20-year-old? I'm like, live, you know, screw up.
Yeah,
get married,
yeah, it's because then
like
you learn.
You know?
Yeah,
you know?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say live. I mean, that's just the thing that I tell everybody. I'm like, you know what, wake up on your porch in your own vomit at least once in your life. I mean, do everything that you can do because this is why we're here. You're here to live. Screw it up. The only thing I'll tell you is when you make a horrible mistake, take some responsibility for it, please, and learn from it, and then go to the next mistake because that's what we're here to do.
Well, you know, we're all works in progress, you know, and I think that takes the pressure off too. You know, I mean, I'll be 56 pretty soon, and I don't dwell on that so much because, you know, I just don't feel it's necessary. But you know, I can feel that I have a lot more wisdom today than I did, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But I know I still don't have all the answers. I don't even have all the questions. You know, I'm not sure I have all the questions. And but you know what? I guess I just sort of feel like I'm being kind to myself because, you know, I don't expect to have all the answers by the time I pass over into the next life.
Right. And isn't that a relief?
It is. It's liberating.
Yeah, because then I don't feel like I have to pass the test. And, you know, I hope that when people read my book or and just listening to you, it's like, you know, I'm 44, you're 56, one of my best friends is 62. And it's such a refreshing experience to talk to her because, you know, it helps me relax into where I'm at in my life. My daughter teases me. She goes, Mom, you're 44. Isn't that old? And I remember, like, when I was 10, like, my mom was in her 40s, and I thought she was ancient. And I said to her, I said, you know, I love being 44. I love it. I love that I'm here. I love when the way my mind is finally feeling awake and alive and conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love it. And she just says, really? Like, you're good with that? I'm like, I think it's awesome, you know? And it's something I tell a lot of young people. I'm like, you know what? Have fun, live your life, and don't worry so much. Because you're going to, you know, the cool thing is that, you know, nowadays we're living a lot longer. And 40 is like the new 20. So I'm like,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, right. You know, or 60 is the new 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, you look at our parents, and they looked like they were in their 60s when they were in their 40s. You know, most
exactly.
of my friends are in their 40s or 50s or 60s. Or I mean, I have a beautiful friend who's in her 70s, and you know what? None of us look as old as our mothers did when they were 50.
No, it's a gift. It's
yes.
Like, I just feel like, oh, I had this awesome experience till I was 40. I made a lot of mistakes. I learned a lot. And so now as I do the next 40 years of my life, I'm still going to make a lot of mistakes, but I'm not going to take them as seriously. You know,
yeah.
My daughter loves to, she's 10, her favorite sentence is, this is the worst day of my life. And I look at her and I'm like, oh, honey.
Trust me, it's not.
It's only going to get worse, baby.
And you know, Betsy, maybe, you know, this idea that we're talking about with the age, maybe we have tipped the sacred cow of ageism, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I think so. But listen, we don't have a whole lot of time yet, and I want to make sure I talk a little bit about the movie, What's the Bleep, because I got emails from listeners. I'm wondering, did that change your life in any way, or did you have those concepts as part of your consciousness before you did the film, or did it change you?
It absolutely changed me. To make a long story short, you know, I didn't have any interest in spirituality. I never spelled the word quantum physics. I'd never done anything before I ended up making What the Bleep Do We Know. I got hired as a producer, and ended up becoming a writer, director, and a producer on the film. And it completely changed my life. I mean, it was a life-altering experience. And I think one, you know, people always ask, well, gee, why was the movie, why do you think the movie was so successful? And I think the short answer to that is that because the filmmakers, Will, Mark, and I, were really genuinely on a quest. You know, we were genuinely asking heartfelt questions, and we were really trying on the information that we were getting, and it was truly authentic. It wasn't like, let's go make a movie and then do this. It was what you felt when you, and that was one of the reasons why I think after the film came out, people were so interested in the filmmakers, which is really rare. I mean, usually when a film comes out, they like the film, and that's really it. That was part of it was interesting because when the film came out, I was always baffled that I would be invited to speak places as if somehow I actually had some sort of answer on it, how to become enlightened. And for a while, I kind of dug that because it fit in with my belief system about I have to know everything. And it was part of the beautiful reason that my whole world came crashing down and I came to the place where I am now. I don't think I would have been able to ever get to where I am now if I hadn't made the belief.
Well, and for listeners who maybe haven't seen it, definitely listeners go, you know, go on the internet, YouTube, rent it, whatever. What the bleep do you know? I mean, basically, would you correct me if I'm wrong, Betsy? But the movie sort of brings science and mysticism and consciousness all together and tells us that we do create our own reality.
Right. Basically, what it says to you. And the whole film basically takes the concepts in quantum physics, molecular biology and neuroscience, and spirituality, and combines them into the concept that you create reality. What I would say to that is that one of the things that I always tell people is, like, look, quantum physics is the study of the nature of reality. It's not a religion, it's not a philosophy, and it's not a reason to stop taking your meds. It's a science. And it's cool, but it's very much really a metaphor. Because for the most part, like, you and I are not literally creating the reality in front of us. Like, you know, there is no Mercedes popping out of our butt because we thought about it. You know, the chair is the chair. The chair was there. You know, you probably went out and bought the chair, which means you created the reality because you went to the store, but you didn't manifest it out of thin air. You know, what you are doing is that you are creating your reality based on your perception of it. You are in complete control of your experience. So
in other words, sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I was just going to say that essentially, you know, you get to decide, do I like this chair or do I not like this chair? Do I want to have, is the chair soft? Do I want to get another chair? It's entirely up to you. So in a sense, you are creating your reality, but I feel like, you know, 10 years after the bleep is 10 years old, it's still very, you know, topical and relevant today. But you know, people sometimes run around thinking, well, if I sit here for 16 hours and meditate, you know, gold coins will fly out of the sky. And, like, the science is proven. I mean, they've done many studies on the double-slit experiment about the observer effect. And, you know, that's highly unlikely that that's going to happen. You know?
Well, I mean, it reminds me of The Secret a little bit, too. You know, The Secret really... I don't know. It feels like I think it gave people unrealistic expectations because I think I always tell my guests, correct me if I'm wrong because I want to get it right. You know, our reality, I think a lot of times, is based on how we react to things. Are we proactive or are we reactive? You know, do we see the glass as half full or the glass as half empty, you know? And that's maybe not all of it, but I think that's part of it. It's not like we are the one that are putting the atoms together to create the table, but if the table breaks, you know, are we going to laugh about it or are we going to cry about it? You know, that sort of thing. But then, like with the water thing with Dr. Yamoto, I think it was that was really. Particularly, I guess, informative, because if we could really change the molecules of water based on the energy we put out, either a loving energy or a angst-filled energy, I think that does say to me, beyond what I've just said, that maybe we do shape things that we can't see. You know, it's just sort of like electricity is there and we can't see it. But
right.
but maybe what we put out in the world does have an effect, even though we can't necessarily see it.
Well, let me give you a brief rundown of how, first of all, it's very interesting because we put the water crystals in the movie and no one's ever actually been able to replicate that in a lab.
Oh,
with that
okay.
being said, you know, CNN now says, you know, people who have a better attitude have a better chance of curing themselves of cancer. Here's why. There was an amazing woman. She was in the film. She passed last year. She was a huge inspiration to me. Her name was Candace Pert. Incidentally, she was like one of the only women on the team that discovered peptides and kind of got brushed aside because she was a woman. But she's amazing. And she wrote a book called Molecules of Emotion, which I highly recommend everybody read, because this is how this works, which is really profoundly life-altering for you if you really think about this. Oftentimes we're taught not to process our emotions. Don't think a negative thought. Don't get caught in anger. Don't do that. Don't feel, because, you know, then you get emotionally drama queen, all that stuff. The truth is that for me, the way I live my life now is if I have an experience and the first emotion that comes up is anger, I let the, instead of trying to shove it away, instead of trying to stop feeling angry, I allow the anger to process through my body. Why? Because each emotion is connected to a chemical, a biological thing in our body called a peptide. If you try to interrupt or stop that pattern midway, it's not going to work. And if you don't, if you allow it to process through and you truly process the emotion and you say, wow, I just felt really angry, okay, do I really want to continue feeling angry, or is there another experience that I could be having? Oh, I really don't, that really isn't something for me to be angry about. I'm going to choose another emotion. That goes away. It floods through your body. If you keep perpetuating anger, you're creating a lot of anger peptides, which are now slamming into your cells and screwing up your cells. That's where sickness comes through. That's what happens with sickness. So if you think about, you know, it's not so much let me slap a positive affirmation on my water bottle and keep repeating it, but underneath, I don't believe that positive affirmation. It's still the same thing. You have to really allow for your time to process your emotions, to process the thought of, you know, gee, I felt angry. I felt angry probably because it pressed my buttons about my belief system, about my body. Okay, I don't really have to perpetuate that anymore. Clean. Done. If I try to say, I don't want to feel angry because it's not very spiritual for me to feel angry, that's not clean, and that peptide is still flying around in your body. That's the sickness. Does that make sense? I mean, I kind of try to do that fast because I know we're running out of time, but that's essentially what that water crystals thing is meaning. You have the ability to completely and utterly alter your cellular level by being in charge of allowing your processes to work properly, allowing yourselves to process emotions, and to be conscious and aware of what you're feeling, and to be able to say, I don't need to feel that emotion anymore because I've allowed it to process.
Well, what would you say then, you know, along this line of thought, to someone who thinks going back to the healing thing, I mean, do you really think that we can affect the outcome of, say, cancer in our body or, you know, or, we'll take that one first, and then I'll ask you a different one.
I think that, first of all, you know, we have the ability to have a huge impact on our health simply by our attitude. With that being said, we have created a reality in which there are toxins everywhere, and with their diets, and there's a lot of other things that go into our bodies besides our thoughts. So do I think it's possibly 100% to cure yourself of cancer with your mind? I do believe it's possible because I personally know people who have done it. With that being said, those people did a lot of work, not just in their mental state, but they did a lot of work in their diet. They did a lot of work in a lot of other ways. And so, you know, you can't just say, oh, I can just totally do it with my mind, and therefore I'm not going to take any medication. I think you have to be balanced. I think, you know, Amma Kasami, who's like one of my favorite physicists on the planet, said to me once, I said, so Amit, is it possible for me to walk through a wall? And he goes, absolutely. It's absolutely possible for you to walk through a wall. And I said, but don't try it. And I said, why? And he said, because you're just not that skilled. you know, there's like, he goes, I don't even know if there's a person on the planet that is that skilled.
Because you'd have to believe it. In other words, is the problem is our belief system gets in the way and would really prevent us from being able to do it. Is that where you're going with that?
That's a big part of it, yeah. And that belief system is, you know, so deeply ingrained. I'm very fascinated with the study of epigenetics right now, which talks a lot about the fact that our genetic makeup is coming from centuries and centuries and centuries ago. So you might be able to really undo some of the belief systems you're carrying around on one dimension of your current life because you have experience around those. They're fresh. They're new. You remember 10 years ago. But you may not even know. This is weird. When my daughter was born, I tried really hard to, like, keep her very, you know, asexual and kind of play with boy toys and girl toys and all that kind of stuff, right? But I often wondered, she had yellow stuff. I mean, I really tried for a while. But there was a part of her that was really just organically drawn to it. And I thought to myself, well, is this a past life? And then I don't know that I believe in reincarnation or don't believe in reincarnation. I don't have proof, so I can't tell you unequivocally yes or no. But with the study of epigenetics, you know, what's really fascinating is that she carries with her the genetics of female, and now with the study of epigenetics, the, like, entire history of her ancestors in her being. She's just born with it. So she already has a lot of the programming that women have gone through for centuries in her. And it presents a lot of the time without having any current exposure. So it's really difficult to say, well, I'm just going to tip that sacred cow right now. That's to me when I say we're not finished. It's like you have a lot of uncovering to do. I mean, every time I think I've uncovered some belief system to the end, you know, just wait 10 days and something will show up to go, ah, I see how that's now connected here.
So we're working on generations and generations of stuff that we're not even aware of.
My father was a gerontologist, and he did a study for the United States government where they were going to abolish welfare. And his study basically stated that because of the amount of generations that have had welfare, if they've had welfare in their family for at least three generations, it will take 3 to 4 generations for the DNA to be deprogrammed for the concept of entitlement. The genetic makeup around entitlement. It takes 3 generations. That was what his study said.
Well, you know, Betsy, it's interesting that you said that because it reminds me of something. When I was in Egypt, I had this incredible, not just a fascination, but a familiarity and a comfort being there. Now, how does someone who's never traveled around the world, this is my first trip out of the country, I go to someplace like Egypt, right? I'm on the cruise ship in the Nile, and I have to tell you, I felt like it was home. And that really stuck with me for a very long time. And in a way, I'm almost thinking that what you're saying may provide the answer, because maybe it was, you know, past life stuff on some level, you know, some life before that made me feel familiar in this life.
Well, I think the thing is interesting because I've had that experience too. The way I'm dealing with the whole concept of past life is that, like, I love to, and maybe I'm making a huge leap here. First and foremost, I should say, I am not a scientist. I'm a mom. Okay, so, but here's my thinking. I have a feeling that eventually the concept of past life will be translated into genetics. And that what's very interesting is you're a very conscious and aware and in tune person. So your listening is much broader than most people, right? We listen at a different level because we listen at a wider perspective or a higher perspective, right? So mm-hmm. because you're more in tune in that way, you're going to be more you're going to hear your genetics more. Does that make sense? Like it's like your genetics start to pull at you.
I can tune in. Maybe I'm tuning in.
Right. And so you hear these things on a cell. You're hearing your body and you're hearing your genetics, and they're all making sounds and vibrations. It's all energy, right? And so
right.
you can hear that much better than, like, most people can because you're in tune. So if you go, as a fun game, go to different places and just sit there and listen and feel it. And then what you'll start to notice is, like, you might have a smell. And then you might realize, like, oh, I smell magnolias, and it's really calling to me. And who knows why that is, but because you're paying attention and you're listening, you'll hear it more. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm terrible.
Yeah, we're not distracted. You know, we're not distracted,
right.
So maybe we tap into, who knows, whether it's, you know, our genetics, our past lives, another dimension. I mean, I think if anything I've learned in this life is that I don't know anything, you know,
right.
Because there's so much, you know, lost history, lost knowledge, maybe yep. knowledge that is humans we haven't even discovered yet. I mean, it's a big, mysterious place out there on so many different levels. You know, there's still so much for us to learn.
If you think about it, for a long time the planet was flat, and now we got that it's round. And for us to think that we figured it out, you know, I guarantee you that we're still in the planet is flat mentality. We just don't know what's coming next.
True. Well, and I think that's probably a really good way to put it, because as soon as we become sure of something, you know, that's when our apple cart will get upset and we will discover that, nope, we didn't have the answers, just like you, you know, when you said just when you thought you maybe had the answers, you realized you didn't.
Right. And you know what? The thing to do in my life is to actually find the fun in that. Humans love to know, and we find safety and comfort in having the answers.
Yeah.
For me, right now, in my own world, I'm living in the, okay, it's totally okay that I don't have the answers. And just practicing that state of being, because it's so anti to everything as a human you're taught to be. You're taught to know. You're taught to be grounded and know all the answers and know where you're going. The 5-year plan, the 10-year plan. People always ask me, "What's your 5-year plan?" I'm like, "I don't even have a week plan. What are you talking about? Like, I'm just kind of walking here, you know." I mean,
well,
to let
it goes back to that whole idea of the journey. You know,
right.
It's the journey. You know, everybody focuses on the destination, which is really, I think, the wrong thing to do. It's just the journey every day, I think, is what we're really supposed to be paying attention to. And when we finally get to the destination, I think that's just sort of the place we take a breath before we start the new journey, you know. And,
right.
And it's the journey that's really the discovery, not the destination.
Well, and the thing is, it's not that I've stopped trying to say wrong thing. It's the way we've been taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just have to realize, oh, okay, I was taught that way, and it actually doesn't mean I have to keep believing that. I'm allowed to actually change my mind,
mm-hmm.
and I'm allowed to change my belief and change my perspective.
I'm big on giving ourselves permission to rethink everything.
Right, right. You know, just because I was this way a week ago doesn't mean I'm going to stay that way.
Right,
and I'm
right.
sorry if you think that. You know, I'm sorry if I'm confusing you is my new rule.
Well, Betsy, this has been fun. Please tell my listeners how they can find your book and if you have anything coming up or, you know, classes or anything like that they should know about, how they would reach you.
Well, they can always find me at BetsyChassie.net. I have a blast on my own little Facebook page, Betsy Chassie. Just look for the picture of the girl with red hair, although I just recently changed my hair back to blonde. And I'm going to be, I'm doing so much stuff. I'm going to the Sun Valley Wellness Festival. I'm going to be doing an event in Santa Fe. I'm going to be doing an event in Los Angeles. There's lots of really awesome stuff coming up. So definitely, you know, come connect with me. And, you know, the Facebook page is really fun. We have a lot of fun there. So join us there. And, you can get my book anywhere. I think at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at any bookstore. I always tell people, if you have a favorite bookstore in town that's small, that's independent, please go there. They probably won't have my book, but they'll order it for you. And I would love it if you would do that, because then you could support some indie bookstores.
Absolutely. We don't need to keep giving our money to multinational corporations like Amazon unless it's just too convenient to do otherwise. You know, like we don't have a car and we need to have it mailed. Well, Betsy, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a lot of fun. And you've made me think about some things. And, you know,
thank
what
you.
Better gift than that?
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Okay. It was fun. Thank you, Betsy. Be well,
bye-bye.
And we'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, it is time to cross the threshold, and to tell you the truth, we are very close to the end of the hour, and I have to get a couple things in here, like Joe Carson and Dancing with
the
Gaia.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected. They were together. That there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, that was Serena Roney Dougal, Ph.D., speaking in Joe Carson's film Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia explores the connections between earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the goddess as Gaia. It features 15 visionaries who give us tools to feel the life of the planet within ourselves. And the DVD comes with a 45-page mini book, and all of that is just $20. And it is a great DVD. I've seen it, listeners. If you're looking for a gift for someone, if you'd like it for your library, I don't think you'll be disappointed. You can get your own copy at dancingwithgaia.com. So thank you, Joe Carson, for the opportunity to run your commercials, because it helps me pay to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. Next week, on the last Wednesday of the month, scholar Alexis Martin will be with us on the show talking about goddess artifacts from Malta. You'll be sorry if you miss it, so please do tune in. And if I wonder, have you had a chance to pick up your copy of Goddess Calling? It truly does show how we can have an alternative to patriarchy and how goddess spirituality sets us free. That's why it's called Liberation Theology, and that's Theology with an A. You can order it from me from my website, KarenTate.com, if you'd like it signed, or get it from any of the local booksellers. Or if you're in a pinch and you want to save money, Amazon has it for sale at a discount price of $12 and a bit of change, or you can get an ebook from them for $7 and a bit of change. And if you love Voices of the Sacred Feminine and you really want to help, please do me a favor and buy the book. So, I do want to close the show with something here. Comes from Pat, a longtime listener. It's called Desiderata, which in Latin means desired things. It's a 1927 prose poem by American writer Max Ehrman, largely unknown in the author's lifetime. The text became widely known after its use in a devotional and after spoken word recordings in the 70s. And this is what he said. He said, "Go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others, even the dull and the ignorant. They too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexations to the spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain and bitter, for always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself, especially do not feign affection. Neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the grass. take kindly the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune. But do not distress yourself with dark imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, Goddess, whatever you conceive him or her to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations and the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be cheerful and strive to be happy. So that was by Max Ehrman, and it's called Desiderata, Desiderata, if you'd like to find it for yourself. So we only have a few minutes here left. Things I didn't get to tonight, I promise I will get to on another show. We ran late, and I thought it was worthwhile to not interrupt, cut our interview short. So because of the issue with Sekhmet, her statue being stolen, I do want to go ahead and play some closing music tonight in her honor as a prayer of sorts that Sekhmet find her way home. And this is a Sekhmet mix by Zingaya. Sekhmet, mother of tenacity manifested, we don't profess to know your mysteries. We don't profess to know your divine plan. But if it is in the plan that you find your way home, we miss you, and we would love to see you back at your temple in Cactus Springs.
Desert, heart, fire.